What really gets my dick hard is...
Hey everyone, this is Tom Kui here from Alpha Metallica, and you're listening to Metal Up, your podcast.
Give me fuel, give me fire, give me that which I desire.
The most popular heavy metal band in the world. They built their success on an uncompromising musical vision and the fierce loyalty of their fans.
We're just four lucky fans that got together and started playing. This could be you.
Their fans are so hardcore and so into them. It's like almost like a religion.
They are the Led Zeppelin of this generation.
For Metallica,
welcome to Metal Up, your podcast. I'm Ethan Luck.
And I'm Clint Wells.
And this is episode 70, and this week we're talking about a great short, but great documentary on VH1, this great series they had for a number of years called Behind the Music, and this, of course, is Metallica's.
Yeah, come with us on a journey down memory lane. I taped this episode on VHS and watched it religiously.
Oh, yeah.
From 1998 to 2002, maybe.
Right.
It was probably one of my... That and Binge and Purge, probably some of my most watched Metallica things that I had.
I mean, it's a bit of a staple if you're a Metallica fan, because there's never really been like a full-on, you know, from start to finish or start to present day documentary done on Metallica, you know, like a tell-all kind of thing. Like, there's glimpses of it in different things like... A Year and a Half Life of Metallica, you know, they go into the Cliff story and things like that. But we've never gotten like a full-on, like fully produced Metallica documentary. Even though everyone knows the whole history of the band, it would be still fun to see. So this is, in my opinion, the closest thing we have.
Yeah, and actually revisiting it today, it doesn't really cut it either. I mean, I think there's literally two sentences on Injustice for All.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they kind of...
They go...
Yeah, this is kind of
straight from Cliff dying to Bob Rock and shit.
Exactly. This is kind of the Cliff's Notes version, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
But it's still entertaining nonetheless, and it's still a great, you know, piece on Metallica to watch. And if you haven't seen it, Jesus, what are you doing? Go get on YouTube or wherever you can find it and go watch it. It's still great stuff to watch. And it's, you know, for nostalgia's sake, too, it's great to see it, you know, because this is still back in an era where, like, Jason was in the band and he's in the documentary a ton, and... It's just great to watch and be reminded of all those awesome things they did back in the day.
Well, it's my era, too. And maybe you feel that way about yourself, too. But 98, that was like, that's my Metallica.
So. Yeah, for sure. Man, I wish it would just have ended like after Justice, because then they like sold out and stuff.
Some guy wrote to me on Twitter recently that he said he couldn't even listen to Justice. He was so disgusted by it. And this is for real. And that Garage Days Revisited is hit the last Metallica record to him.
Oh, okay. I think we've also had a similar email maybe one time. I don't remember. But and maybe I saw the same thing on Twitter where it was basically like Garage Days is the last good sounding thing they've done.
Right.
I'm gonna go ahead and disagree.
Couldn't get through Blackened because he was so disgusted by how awful it was. Blackened.
Ew, gosh, Blackened! What a terrible sellout song. You guys are awful.
For those of you who are first joining us, maybe you heard about us last week. We got a lot of people writing in this week saying they heard us on Spotify.
Cool.
Which I've not had a lot of nice things to say about it, but apparently people are finding us there. Which is cool. So if you're hearing us for the first time, we're an All Metallica podcast. Ethan and I are two professional touring musicians based in Nashville. Every week we try to make time within our busy schedules to talk about our favorite metal band of all time, the mighty Metallica. You can go leave us an iTunes review if you want to. It's really easy to do. It's real helpful. We've been doing these contests with iTunes where if you leave us a review, we give you a prize. But for the month of April, and I think even May, we are doing a Patreon giveaway. Now, we're going to talk about Patreon a little later. If you're not sure about what it is, it's just it's a platform for people who want to give back to content creators, because that's what right. We create content.
We do. We've created now 70 episodes of content.
And Patreon's a cool way for you to go there. If you're saying, hey, these motherfuckers get together every week and they take time out of their schedules away from their families to talk about my favorite band, how do I support them in some way? Patreon's kind of created this cool way where we can give you gifts to do it and all this. Yeah. Now, we have about 110, 115 patrons. We're going to be giving them 5 prizes for the month of April and May. For the month of April, it's the Captains of Crunch poster.
That's a good one.
The Puss Head Hockey Puck, a sealed Beyond Magnetic CD.
Sealed hardwired CD. Right?
A sealed hardwired CD. And the the Mexico City DVD, which is
what's a CD? I stream everything for free.
I'm not used to paying for content.
Since I've grown up, everything's for free, and I just take it.
Look, I used to be this many, now I'm this many.
So anyway, go check out Patreon. We're going to hear about that a little later. We did get a bunch of new patrons this week, though, that we wanted to say hello to.
Yeah, we got a bunch. This is awesome. Some of our new patrons are Jeremy Colley Holmes, Chad Pollock, Robert Maher?
John Mayer, yes.
John Mayer. Robert Bubash. Bubash. That's a cool last name. Justin Adair, Chris Reynolds, and Andy Brown. All right. Thank you, guys. Thank you so much.
We really appreciate you guys.
And we do appreciate it. It means the world to us. As you know, it helps. This website helps us maintain all this shit, like the website to the domain name to hosting the podcast, all that stuff. So we can't thank you enough.
Speaking of the website, we have a bitchin' website, metalupyourpodcast.com. You can go there and you can see that we have t-shirts for sale and stickers. And you can also hear clips of our EP. Maybe you've heard our last episode, our bonus episode. Was about the making of Cover Our Black, and where Ethan and I took a bunch of Metallica deep cuts and recorded them with our various guitars and basses and
voices
and
drums and
other various instruments. You can see all that at metalupyourpodcast.com. We're on all the socials, Instagram. We've been doing these really cool things called Instagram Live.
We're actually obviously it's over as you're listening to this episode, but we are currently, as you're listening to this, doing our first Instagram Live video while we do our intro and emails, which is kind of weird because I feel like there's a crowd over here. There's like a whole crowd watching. Thankfully, we can't hear them. Otherwise, we would have lost it by now. But yeah, so we've been on Instagram just hanging out with our Metal Up Your Podcast fans, Metallica fans, answering questions, giving them tours of our studios, this and that. And it's been fun. You know, it's a good way to connect to you guys, and we'll keep doing it.
So, yeah, so check out that Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, all that stuff. The best way to get a hold of us is our email address, which is metalupyourpodcastshow@gmail.com. Every week we read a few emails because we like hearing from these motherfuckers and we like engaging with people and cultivating a community of Metallica fans. Let's go to the email corner.
Let's do it. All right, our first email is from Paul M. Hey, guys, I found this podcast a week or so ago, and it's awesome. I work night shift and listen to you guys as well. I also listen with my 14-year-old son. I'm sorry. Should we stop cussing as much?
No, he's 14. Okay. He's fine.
Well, shit. All right. Who's also a huge fan of both the show and the band. We're heading to one of the two Canadian shows this September. It's his first. Oh, that's awesome. Lastly, the impressions are great. I drive the wife crazy using the Dave impression. She comes home and says, "I'm home," and I reply, "Hello, dear." Anyways, great podcast. Keep it up. That's awesome.
I do have to say, Paul, that also having a wife that's not real impressed with a Metallica or heavy metal or my impressions, I understand her pain and I understand your plight, because it's almost like when your wife doesn't like it, it makes me want to do it more.
I haven't really tried out any of my impressions on my wife, only because it's going to require a full-on backstory, which I don't really... It's not going to make it any better.
I do not do the Dave hello voice to my wife when she comes home from work. I save that strictly for sexy time.
Ooh. Clint slips into bed, takes an Ambien, leans over and goes, "Oh, hello, honey.
Hello, good luck. Hey, good looking."
And his wife's going...
She's going, "Please, just pretend you're asleep. Pretend to be asleep." All right.
He's not here.
Fabricio Roig says, "Hello, guys. Just got into your podcast 3 days ago because I got a corneal transplant surgery."
Wow.
He says, "While recovering, I can't watch TV or even go out of my house, so I've just been listening to your podcast all day. At first, I thought it may be boring to have a podcast only about Metallica and that it would be snobby, quote-unquote, experts with all the facts. I started hearing you, and it was just great. Two simple dudes talking about Metallica with passion, getting some things right, others outlaw torn. But that's what it's all about, what makes the listener feel part of the convo. Thank you, guys. Your show's great. I'd love it if you could comment about the Metallica silence. Those dramatic pauses are the best." I'm guessing you're talking about like the Harvester of Sorrow pause. There's a big pause in Sad But True.
Yeah.
There's a big pause in Dream No More, like right before the solo.
That's true. I mean, God, I mean, whatever the reasoning behind it is, we back it because... It makes those sections of those songs so special and so cool. And there's that slight, you know, let's say the pause is like 4 or 5 seconds, there's that anticipation like, oh, it's about to hit back in and it's really hard and heavy. And
there's a really good pause in Devil's Dance too.
Yeah.
Let's Dance.
Yeah, it's right there.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know it.
I like the one. Is it on, what'd you say on, was it not Confusion?
No, Dream No More.
On Dream No More, is that the one where you hear,
yeah,
like a little breath? Yeah, yeah. I dig that one.
And it's, you know, Dream No More, I mean, in a lot of ways, Hardwired is kind of a callback to a lot of great moments in their career.
Right,
Dream
yeah.
No More is very much a, it's kind of a combination of Memory Remains and Sabbath True.
Yep.
So some of those moments are really deliberate. Moth in the Flame has a lot of elements of Disposable Heroes. Hardwired, obviously, a lot of elements of Battery.
Yep.
And Fight Fire. It's, agreed. Et cetera.
Et cetera.
All right, our next email.
Next email is from our longtime listener, good friend of the show, Sarah Sobeck.
What's up, Sarah?
Hey, Sarah. She's probably over here, right? Is she on Instagram watching?
I think she is with us on Instagram.
What's up,
Live?
Sarah? What's up, Sarah, on the show and on Instagram?
This is like the Truman Show.
I know, it's weird.
Except pretty much nothing like the Truman Show.
Yeah, I don't have that nice of a house. And I don't have a sweet...
That's why it's not like it.
That's why. And I don't have a sweet raft that I'm eventually going to like row into like a fake sunset. Not a funny joke if you've never seen that movie. But anyways.
Or if you've seen it.
Or if you have. It's just a bad joke either way. All right. Sarah Sobeck writes in and says, hey guys, I met up with my Metallica brother Brett in Georgia last weekend, and he mentioned to me that he wants to send you guys his Metallica Budweiser cans. I have the HQ2 address, so I just want to make sure it'd be okay to give it to him. And for those of you listening, that address of Clint's house is 12...
My social security number is this, and my stool sample weighs this much.
Stool sample, that's how identities get stolen, Clint. You be careful.
It's all on the stool.
It's all on the stool, man. All your DNA is in there. Well, that's very cool, first of all. We've been talking about, you know, over the years, or years, over the episodes, man, it'd be cool if we had some of those Budweiser cans, and it looks like we're going to get some.
Yeah, great.
She says, also, I can't remember which episode you spoke about dates to the movies. P and I went to a ton of movies, and we were dating in the late 90s, our very first date was to a movie, and the movie was so bad, we both fell asleep, and we were woken up by the usher after the place had already cleared out. Well,
thanks for letting us know what the movie was.
Yeah,
I'm so
movie
curious.
Is that? And if it was Coming to America, you're no longer our friend. Because that is comedic gold.
Totally.
She ends her email by saying, as always, love you guys and what you do for us. Thanks for helping get us through the work week. Peace and adios, Sarah.
Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you, Sarah.
Our next email is from Thomas Zill. He says, hi, guys. Currently listening to your EP. To be honest, I'm not the biggest fan of Metallica tribute / cover albums, especially not of those albums on which the artists use just minimal effort to record the songs, which then end up sounding like cheap, uninspiring knockoff versions of Metallica. He says, but your EP is the exact opposite of that. I knew what to expect when listening to the teaser songs you've included in your episodes back in November, but I'm still blown away, especially the unnamed feeling in Sanitarium. Left me speechless. You've created your own beautiful renditions of already great Metallica songs. Well done. Beer's on me when you end up in Hamburg, Germany, New Jersey one day. Cheers, Thomas. Thanks,
man,
dude.
Thomas, that's very, very kind. First of all, thank you for those kind words. And I wish you would have written in before, man. I was in Hamburg like last summer. And it's a cool town.
Dude, Sarah just wrote it was the postman and that it sucks. She's so right.
The postman, Kevin Costner?
Yeah.
It's pretty bad. It's like
it does
it's like
suck.
15 hours long. And it's I remember it being really bad. I saw that.
I just love that she wrote it was the postman, .. Sucks.
It's pretty bad. All right, next email is from Chad Pollock.
I got to say real quick before we read Chad's email.
This is for you.
Well, Chad's one of the dudes who came to my Bob Schneider tour.
Oh, nice. Very
I believe
cool.
in Iowa. And
awesome.
I got to hang out with Chad and his wife. And
very
really cool,
cool
dude.
He's the one that you said you never wanted to talk to again, right?
Fuck you. Don't,
I'm just kidding.
Don't believe it, Chad. Don't believe it.
Sorry, Chad. This is technically for you, but I guess I'll read it. Clint, thanks for expressing your feelings on Pantera. Their music is so fucking good, but the older, mellow version of me can't stand the bro legacy that Phil attached to the band. I love Dimes' music and really think he was an innovator. Looking back on Phil's tough guy act is so embarrassing. I don't know if I call his, Phil Anselmo's, I wouldn't call it a bro legacy. It's more of just like a junkie legacy who embarrasses the band. He's a racist.
Yeah, it's kind of both.
I mean, if I think of a bro, I mean, coming from Southern California, a bro is like a dude that drives a lifted truck with a Hurley hat kind of cocked sideways and listens to Pennywise bro him all the time.
Pennywise.
It's true. Not
there
the
are
clown.
Different, all right, but just there are different kinds of bros.
There are. In the South, we call them rednecks.
Totally. He is a total redneck.
He says, however, Rebel Meets Rebel still gets regular rotation when I'm looking for something heavy. Do you guys have any love for this
amalgamation? For those of you who don't know, Rebel Meets Rebel, it's basically David Allan Coe with Rex Brown, Dimebag Darrell, and Vinnie Paul.
Oh, okay.
It's all right. It's pretty cool.
I'm not a big David Allan Coe fan. So
the whole point of me being bummed about Phil is that I love the music that he makes with those right, three guys. Right. So just replacing Phil is not really going to cut it for me because I love his deal. It's just a shame he's in his personal life kind of a shitty dude.
Now, I have said this in the past. I can't remember if I mentioned this on the show or not. When a singer dies or a huge member dies like a Dimebag Darrell, I'm not ever into like, hey, you should do a tour. But in this case, I always thought, I mean, I remember like shortly after he passed away and was unfortunately murdered. I remember my first thought was, man, not my first thought, but shortly after, if they ever did a tribute tour to Dime, why not have Rex Brown, Vinnie Paul, Phil Anselmo, and Zakk Wylde?
I
think he's the only guitar player that could do it.
I have a very unpopular opinion about this.
Okay.
I don't think Zakk Wylde's good enough. Dimebag Darrell is my favorite metal guitar player of all time. Sorry, Kirk. Sorry, Tony Iommi. Sorry, whoever the fuck.
Sorry, guy from Puddle of Mud.
Sorry, Wes...
Borland.
Jezelnik. What's his name?
Wes Jezelnik? Who's... Wes Jezelnik.
Wes Scantlin. That's
Wes
it.
Scanlon?
Scanlon. Scranton?
Who was he? What band?
From Puddle of Mud.
Oh, that's really his name?
Yes, Wes Scantlin.
No, I don't know.
God
don't,
damn it.
I don't listen to them.
I think Marty Friedman could do it.
Oh, absolutely, Marty Friedman.
Like, because Zakk is no joke.
I think Zakk could do it.
He's too sloppy. Dime was extremely precise.
He was precise.
Zakk is very sloppy.
Marty is too busy hosting game shows in Japan.
Marty's big. He's big in Japan.
He is.
I'm big in Japan.
Big in Japan.
You guys heard that Tom Waits tune? All right. What does the end of his email say?
He says, thanks for the great work. Gotta run. There is still a witch at the door with a howling wolf and a three-headed armadillo. I think she's selling Girl Scout cookies. Well, sign me up for some Thin Mints.
By all means, open that door.
Sign me up for some Thin Mints and tag-alongs.
Thanks, Chad. Really good to hear from you,
Thank you.
And Chad became he's donated before. He donated privately just straight to our PayPal, but he actually became an official patron this week. So
he donated privately straight to our bus.
That is Clint Wells' humor rubbing off on Ethan, by the way.
I was exactly going for that. I wanted to crack a Clint Wells joke.
Our last email, Kevin Palmy writes, hello again, Clint and Ethan. Oh, shit. Let me say one thing before I read Kevin's email. I started reading Rex Brown's book.
Oh, it was recommended
Which is called Official Proof, that whatever it is.
Was it Kevin that gave us that excerpt a few weeks ago?
I don't remember who it was, but just because Chad mentions Pantera. Now, we read an email where someone sent us an excerpt from Rex Brown's book where he talks about the guys from Metallica were laughing about how they intentionally didn't put bass on Justice to fuck with Jason. And he's like, well, you heard it from me. Like, a lot's been said about it, but I'm just telling you, when we saw them, they were laughing their asses off, right?
Right, yeah.
I'm about 100 pages into Rex's book, and I can tell you that it is not to be trusted. The dude sounds like a total fucking idiot and a redneck.
Really?
So I'm reading it just sort of incredulously, like, wow, I can't believe this guy wrote some of this shit.
Wow, okay.
So anyway, take that for what it's worth.
Okay.
Kevin Palmu, hello again, Clint and Ethan. I wanted to add something about the bass solos that came up in the last show regarding San Diego. The variation on the Orion bass line that Jason plays is likely familiar because it shows up on the demo CD of the Puppets box set. On an early version of that part of the song, it kind of sounds like James playing that little riff. When I first listened to the CD, I was like, oh, so that's where Jason got it from.
Oh, okay.
That's interesting, right?
Interesting. Yeah, for sure.
He says, similarly, when they do To Live Is To Die jams, the bass line that Jason plays can be first heard on the demo tape for that song. I'm not 100% sure, but my understanding is that the whole middle section of the song was built off of Cliff's part. Maybe we'll find out more when the Justice box set comes out.
I hope so.
Thanks again. Now I got to get back to walking in some spider webs.
So leave a message and we'll call you back, Kevin. God, what a great record, Tragic Kingdom.
Yeah, Tragic Kingdom is a... Dude, don't speak.
Oh, dude. I know just what you're thinking.
So don't... Please don't stop explaining.
Don't tell me because it hurts.
There we go.
No, don't speak.
I know what you're saying.
Dude, that record... I mean, I'm from Southern California, and I was living in Orange County at the time when that came out in 96, if I remember right, 95. I was driving to school, and I heard Just a Girl on the radio on K-Rock, and I was
just
like...
Just a Girl, that's the other one, yeah.
Yeah, Just a Girl.
And I'm just a girl in the world.
That's all we are, man. We're just two ladies in the world just trying to do a podcast. I remember how excited I was for that band, because they were a local like Orange County band from Anaheim, and I was like, is that No Doubt and Gwen Stefani? That's cool. Anyways, that's the emails, I guess, right?
Let's get out of the email corner. Ladies and gentlemen, that was the fucking emails.
That's it. We'll be right back. Hey, this is Ethan and Clint from Metal Up Your Podcast, and we want to talk to you about something we love called Patreon.
That's right. Patreon is a way for fans of the show to give back to the show, to donate money that helps us in quality and content. And not only that, but we've actually come up with all sorts of fun incentives to give back to you for supporting the show.
Exactly. For instance, if you donate $5 or more, you get access to Cover Our World Blackened, which is the official Metal Up Your Podcast Metallica cover EP.
That's right, and that's the only way to get it. In addition to the EP, we also give you priority email access, meaning we'll read your email first on the show. We give you early access to Patreon-exclusive merchandise, Patreon-exclusive giveaways, and any other side projects that Ethan and I might be involved in.
There's all sorts of things you can look at on there and you can donate to. Go check it out, patreon.com/metalupyourpodcast. How do you spell that, Clint?
patreon.com/metalupyourpodcast. And if you really think about it, $5 a month for an entire year, that's really just like a cup of coffee a month. So go check it out. Thanks, everyone. Peace.
Adios.
All right. Well, let's talk about Behind the Music. Now, there is, around 2010, VH1 was doing this thing like called, they were updating some of the old Behind the Music.
Right, yeah. It's pretty and much Metallica, like they added on the end, like what's going on currently at that time.
Well, they kind of added like, well, they added like the 10 years prior. So right. Like Metallica making Saint Anger, winning a Grammy for Saint Anger, the making of Death Magnetic, they won a Grammy for My Apocalypse. It's maybe 10 additional minutes.
Yeah.
Now, I think that has, I saw it on YouTube maybe like 4 months ago. I think it's been taken down. I couldn't find it. So we're doing the original Gangster 1998 commentary.
Oh, G.
And you know how you know it's from 1998? Because this motherfucker starts with clips from the Fuel video.
Oh, yeah. Give me fuel, give me fire. They were America's hottest band.
And, you know, there. Wow, you sound just like the guy from Behind the Music.
I actually did all the narration for Behind the Music, which is, no, most people don't know.
I swear, I found that dude's voice so comforting. I think that one of the many reasons I watched it so many times, because I like that dude's voice.
Well, and I think that that's a big reason why you would watch Behind the Music episodes about artists you didn't care for.
Totally. Like Leif Garrett. You remember the Leif Garrett one?
Yeah, Leif Garrett, Behind the Music. Hear the story that has never been told.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you won't believe it. And like, well, I probably will believe it, but I just want to hear you soothe me to sleep, sir.
I love in the intro to every Behind the Music, there's like the montage of, you know, they put in every single one, and there's one clip of like, you know, from the perspective of the artist, like walking backstage towards the stage, and there's a guy that's probably the sleazy manager. He like kisses his fingers. He's like, come on, baby, let's go to stage. It's so bad.
Or there's like someone sobbing. They're like, you won't believe it.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Because Leif Garrett actually like killed a guy or something.
They went from fame and fortune to having nothing.
Yeah. And then like a phoenix rose from the ashes, then went down into the flames of obscurity again, but then rose like another phoenix. There are some pretty classic moments in this opening montage, though. It's like, again, this shit's just so emblazoned in my brain, but James saying, the we're just four lucky fans who got together and started playing. This could be great. You.
Oh, yeah.
The dude saying, they are the Led Zeppelin of this generation.
I mean, kind of.
No, I agreed then. I agree now. Although their careers lasted a hell of a lot longer than Led Zeppelin's did. A
little bit, yeah. I mean, I'd say there's probably a couple bands, you know, obviously maybe Metallica be number one, but like, you know, maybe, you know, bands like Soundgarden, you know, or Nirvana might be like the as far as like how long Led Zeppelin lasted, maybe they might be a better comparison. But I don't know. I mean, Led Zeppelin were doing things back then that people were like, what the hell is this? And Metallica did the same thing and changed the face of music.
Yeah, and I don't think Nirvana or Soundgarden ever got as big as... I mean, you already quantified that, but...
Right.
I think it's a pretty good comparison.
Yeah, me too.
And in terms of just absolute influence, lasting legacy, etc.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, Kirk has done for the wah pedal what Jimmy Page did with the violin bow.
Exactly. I would venture to say that Jimmy Page used way less violin bow or cello bows or whatever than Kirk has used wahs.
Yeah, probably even something gratuitous like 95% less, maybe right. Even 98%
less. Did Jimmy Page have a signature bow? I think not. Did Dunlop make him a bow?
And I think Jimmy Page really only did it on like one song on Led Zeppelin 1.
Right, exactly.
On every song.
He did it on that P. Diddy song.
Come with me. Ga-ga-ga.
Yeah.
Ga-ga.
From Godzilla.
No, wait. I'm like talking to the young boy now. I'm like, you realize that was a Led Zeppelin song, right? From Physical Graffiti called Kashmir?
No, that was P. Diddy.
What? What, the P. Diddy song?
I love P. Diddy.
I think at this point, that cover, or whatever that was, that reimagining,
right,
was so old that he was still called Puff Daddy. That's how old it was.
He was called Puff Daddy. No, it's interesting when somebody like that samples a song, you know, like, for instance, Snoop Dogg sampling Sabbath True. But one of the ones that's somewhat more relevant, I can't remember the name of the song, but that artist, M.I.A.,
yeah,
it basically her most famous song that has like the gunshots in it. It's a sample of The Clash's Straight to Hell. And every time I hear it and I see people like reacting to it, I'm like, you motherfuckers, that's The Clash. And they're but it's M.I.A. and there's gunshots. And I feel like a gangster if I put my hand in the air.
My friend Brad Lyons tells a pretty funny story about arguing with a guy in a coffee shop about so I guess this guy was asserting his quote unquote knowledge by saying, he's like, you know, Dave Matthews did not write All on the Watchtower. Jimi Hendrix did. And Brad said, he was like, well, actually, it's a Bob Dylan song. This guy was like, are you out of your fucking mind?
Dude, it's not.
Like, no, it's not. Bob Dylan? What? He's like, God damn it.
I know,
I'm pulling
man.
Up just for fun, just for nostalgia.
Okay.
I'm pulling up. It's Puff Daddy featuring Jimmy Page. Can you hear this?
Yep. Yeah, Bad Boy for Life.
Yeah, yeah. Turn my headphones up.
Yeah, turn my headphones up.
No, turn my computer off.
I just remember that was from the Godzilla soundtrack, which I believe also featured the Wallflowers covering David Bowie, Heroes.
Yeah, Heroes.
Yeah.
We could be heroes, yeah.
Yeah, that was a good cover.
Yeah. Well, the Wallflowers are good, and David Bowie's great, so no problems there.
Yeah, Led Zeppelin is great, and Puff Daddy is P. Diddy.
One of the things that I think works so much about this Behind the Music, especially for when we were kids, is, like, I was trying to make notes on it and follow it. It's kind of jumpy. It's like they go from all these montages, and then it's like suddenly we're at the VMAs and the band's playing Inner Sandman.
Right. Well, and the way that the format always worked was every time they went to a commercial, they would show a little preview of, hey, what's to come, you know, and then, you know, they got the name Alcoholica and see what happened next. And then they go through, then they, you know, backtrack again, and it can be a little confusing, but I mean,
they're trying to cram so much information in what's essentially, without commercials, like a 43-minute, you know, documentary.
Right. I mean, Metallica definitely, at some point in their career or post-career, definitely need, like, what Tom Petty got with Running Down a Dream. They need at least a 4-hour-long documentary.
They've got that when Metallica ruled the world. That's pretty cool.
It's similar, though.
No, I agree.
It's still great, great content and a really cool thing to watch. But yeah, I mean, if you want to do this band justice and do like an awesome documentary on them, that shit's got to be 4 hours long.
There's a moment where they're kind of all describing sort of what each band member brings to the table. And of course they talk of James as being the heart and soul, you know, the creative heart and soul.
Right.
Lars is the contract guy and the arranging. Jason is the live guy. They call him the never-ending connection with fans, which I thought was super apropos.
Very.
But then when they get to Kirk, they describe Kirk as the slightly insane free spirit.
Who rides a unicorn when he's not touring.
Like, yeah, like, wouldn't you have rather than been like, you know, Kirk is this sort of ripping, monster, legendary guitar player who's also kind of a zany free spirit. But they're like...
I think it would have been more like, you know, more appropriate to the content of the documentary if they said, I mean, he wrote Enter Sandman.
I know, totally.
You know, even if they just complimented him on that one riff he wrote, that's much better than saying Kirk's a slightly insane free spirit.
Or if they'd been like, you know what, Kirk isn't kind of crazy, this sort of like, and they're just sort of like zoning out. Kirk's like, but you know what? He did write Enter Sandman, so...
So give us your thoughts on Kirk, James. He had some sick LeBray piercings, and his jewelry choice was amazing.
He's got a really great tattoo around his belly button.
Oh, man.
And look, say what you will about the man. He motherfucker knows how to put guyliner on.
Yeah, it's flawless.
I wanted to insert a clip. I don't know if you want to make a marker, but James talking about growing up in Downey and, you know, apparently being raised by strict Christian Scientists. And
James Hetfield was born in Downey, California in 1963 and raised in a strict Christian Science family broken by divorce. When James was a teenager, cancer claimed his mother's life.
doctors, hospitals are kind of like taboo, and with the help of God, you will get better. You know, you're kind of going with it, but you feel it's not quite right, and you're at school, and okay, now it's time for health class, and I have to get up and leave. You know, learning about the body wasn't necessary. This is a shell, and what's true is your soul and all this. So actually leaving class and then getting, you know, all the little kids. So that was the beginning of alienation, I believe, as a child.
We all know the story. His mom got diagnosed with cancer, but because of their religious beliefs, they were taught not to take medicine, and she, of course, passed away. And good grief. He talks about having to, like, actually walk out of health class.
Yeah.
And he describes that as the beginning of his alienation.
Well, it's interesting, too. I mean, if you think about this this documentary, VH1, I mean, this came out in the late 90s. This is still pre-Sober James. I'd imagine at this point he's still dealing pretty heavily with, like, abandonment issues from his mother's death to his father leaving and all that stuff, you know. You know, you can really get a sense, I think, when he's talking about, you know, being raised by a Christian Scientist and his mom not taking medicine and all this stuff for cancer, you can still kind of see, like, his pain and anguish from it.
Oh, yeah. There's anger in there.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that, you know, 98, that's right after Reload came out, you can hear it in songs like Fixer. And
right.
Of course, it's in The God That Failed and Dyer's Eve. And
Fade
Invisible
to Black.
Kid,
Fade
Invisible
to Black.
Kid be later. Yeah, Whiplash, you know.
It's definitely in Motor Breath.
And then they sort of contrast that with Lars in Denmark, who had a fairly charmed life, a super cool fucking dad. And, you know, he was a tennis pro. But I love that when he talks about how in Denmark he was a somebody, but he says when he came to the States in 1980, he wasn't even top 10 on his block.
Yeah. Which, how many tennis players lived on Lars's block when he moved to Hollywood?
Well, I don't know. Yeah, totally. No, in fucking, yeah, Venice. I'm going to guess 25.
Yeah, probably 25. I mean, LA is a big place. There's a lot of people and probably a lot of tennis pros. I mean, for those who don't know, I'm from Southern California, as I've mentioned all the time. Trust me, I grew up out there. There's a big tennis scene, especially in the early 80s in Hollywood.
Especially if you were into the new wave of British heavy metal and you were Danish.
Well, yeah, I mean, in California, we consider that the new wave of tennis. With all these Danish people coming over to try to take over our tennis scene.
The new wave of Danish tennis?
Yeah. Unfortunately for Lars, he never got into tennis core. That was a pretty big genre of music back
right.
then.
Right. Well, what they didn't know is that, yeah, thrash tennis was about to happen. We get into groove tennis, black tennis, death tennis, tennis.
Don't get me started on rap tennis.
Dude, doom tennis is when you just hit the ball super slow.
It's super slow, and you can your whole scenario turns into slow motion. You can see the tennis ball, like, just slowly flexing from the tennis racket hitting it. It's just real slow.
It's like the Matrix.
Oh, yeah.
We get to hear about, of course, the boys meeting each other and the recycler, you know, and they met, and James famously talks about the symbol that kept falling over. And it's interesting, I watching this now when I was a kid, there's interview clips with Ron McGovney, and I don't remember connecting dots back then. But
yeah, it's great.
It's interesting to see that Ron McGovney's in there, and we talked about this, I believe, on the Lars episode, but so James wasn't very impressed, you know, with that jam.
Right.
And then Lars kind of went to Europe and followed a bunch of bands and slept on Motorhead's couch or Diamondhead's couch and shit. And then Lars came back and he had secured that slot on Brian Slagle's Metal Massacre, right? And James actually, I'd sort of pontificated earlier that even though James didn't really like Lars's playing, the idea of having that slot on a legitimate metal compilation.
Right, yeah.
You know, kind of, he was like, well, I guess I'll just try it out again. And he actually says in the Behind the Music, he talks about, I don't know if it was being greedy, but wanting to play with Lars, even though he didn't think he was very good, you know?
Right. Well, I mean, it's clear that James saw something in Lars, maybe his motivation, his willingness to, like, you know, whatever, go follow bands around. James saw that Lars had this insane desire to make something of himself and to be part of this new scene happening. And it was, I mean, back then, it's like, I mean, all the way up until even when I was playing and starting in bands, it's like, if you can get on like a cool compilation, you don't know how many people that's reaching, but the fact that your one song is on a tape or whatever was so exciting to know that. And, you, and the tape comes out and there's artwork and you're like, you can put it in like, dude, our song is on here. This is so cool. So, I mean, it was a hell of a lot more than James had, you know?
Well, it also just makes me wonder how bad was Lars really? He couldn't have been that bad. Plus, how good was James really? Probably not that good.
Right.
In terms of singing, at least.
He was good enough to wear a leopard glove.
Well, the leopard glove was kind of like Samson's hair. Like, if you take that leopard glove off, he has no metal power anymore.
Right. Yeah, and for those of you that don't know, James actually keeps it in his pocket when he plays live still. What if that was his rabbit's foot? Like, he's got that glove just tucked in his pocket or whatever pants he's wearing at every show, even to present day. And it's like, man, this is where it all came from, man.
What if that leopard glove was what was in the bag in through the Never movie?
I think you might be right.
But like, holy, you know what? It wasn't the soul of Cliff at all. It was that one fucked out Michael Jackson leather leopard glove.
I mean, that bag could have fit his whole outfit for all we know. The pants are in there. That
bullet belt, fishnet cut off shirt.
Oh yeah, hot.
They talk about how, you know, we know that sort of the impetus for Cliff joining the band is that they wanted to move to he wanted them to move to San Francisco, and they do kind of talk about how that they weren't really fitting in with the image of LA,
right?
Anyway.
Yeah.
Which, that's interesting. It's just there's so many. We talked about it on our 1982, 83, or 81, 82 episode. Just so many near misses in these early days.
Oh, yeah.
With seeing Trauma play and going up and seeing him and getting Cliff in the band, deciding to move to San Francisco. And so many things could have been very different.
Well, there's so many things that happened before they even recorded their first record that,
right,
that it's could, true. That what could have been, you know, like everything from obviously them kicking Dave out to, you know, Ron quitting to them moving to San Francisco to getting rid of the leather or the the leopard glove, you know.
Well, they actually say there's so many things that I didn't pick up on when I was a kid, but they actually insinuate pretty heavily that Ron quit the band because of Dave.
Yeah, they do. Because they got in a lot of fights, and there's that story in there where you know, Dave was drunk and they were rehearsing, and he just poured an entire beer like down his bass into the pickups, and I mean, at this point they're rehearsing in like Ron's parents' garage.
Right. He's like, get out of my house, you butthole.
Exactly. Like, you're being an asshole. Like, goodbye, Dave.
Well, Dave actually says, he's like, you know, when we got drunk together, the other three got silly, and he says, but I got violent.
Oh, yeah.
And silly and violent don't mix. Yeah, it's like, dude, no one wants to be around that.
Right.
No one.
Exactly.
Except maybe other violent assholes.
I think other violent drunks or angry drunks, you know, maybe they cancel each other out when they drink too much or something, or they just both forget that they fought each other the night before.
Now, there is a clip I wanted to insert here. I just got a kick out of it because it's like kind of like a road montage, but they're playing the song Better Than You in the background.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome.
Metallica moved to San Francisco in the spring of 1983 and rented a small house in El Cerrito. These were lean times for the band, but they had found a home for their unique brand of metal.
We just moved all the furniture out of the house and invite 50 headbanging friends over. Put Venom on the stereo and just thrash the place, you know?
By the time you walk in the club, you just be like, metal rules! That guy's got a blonde stripe in his hair. Kill him! Kiss him! Motley Crue creep! You know, it's like that. At one point, we were tearing people's shirts off that said bands we didn't like.
There was kids with denim jackets on that had Metallica patches on the back, and the support band was playing, and they turned around, they turned their backs on them, and we're standing there doing this, you know? And it's like, wow. They're loyal to us. They're our people, you know?
And I just love that. It's in your awesome. Face, Tom. In your
Take it, Tom
face,
Quee.
Dude. Has Tom done an episode on Behind the Music? I think he may have already done an episode
maybe.
On this.
Maybe. Well, guess what? We're doing it, Tom.
We're doing it, Tom. Sorry. Excuse
you know
us.
What?
Pardon me.
Cheers, mate.
Pardon me, Tom. Hi, and hello, and welcome back.
This is Tom Quay from Alpha Metallica. Is that pretty good, Tom?
They're interviewing the guy from Exodus, and he's talking about the sort of the tribalism of that time. And he talks about how if people were wearing shirts of bands they didn't like, they were like ripping the shirts off of people.
I know.
Can you imagine? Like, I can't imagine ripping, like when I was in high school, like ripping off someone's Korn shirt.
Right, exactly.
Because then what? Well, then you have to like deal with them even more than I, you know, like, well, I'm sorry I ripped your shirt off. And
but you know, well, the band sucks. And,
they're like, damn it, dude.
I'd imagine for us, like in our mid to late 30s, you know, nowadays, the equivalent of that would be some freaking, you know, pop Instagram celebrity wearing a Ride the Lightning t-shirt. And you'd be like, motherfucker, take that shit off.
I forgot to mention this when we were talking about t-shirts the other day. When I won't say where on the air, I'll tell you where privately, but
I went
somewhere in Nashville. And it was these two dudes that you know, that we both know, and I like them a lot, but I don't know them as well.
Right.
And one of them was wearing a bitchin' vintage-looking Creatures of the Night Kiss shirt.
Okay.
And, like, Kiss fans are like, when we see each other in the wild, it's like, it's similar to Metallica fans. Like, you know that you're part of a team, you know? But now these days with these fashion dudes who wear shirts of bands they know nothing of, you got to kind of check in.
Right, yeah.
My way of, like... It wasn't like a name three songs off Creatures, but my question to him was, I was like, dude, Creatures of the Night, that's an amazing shirt. He's like, oh, yeah, man, thanks. I said,
I got it at Target.
No, I said, now listen, are you wearing that shirt or are you wearing that shirt? You know what I mean?
Like, yeah, oh, yeah.
Are you wearing it or are you really wearing it? He's like, what do you mean, bro? What do you mean? You know, like, I had to be like, all right, do you know, are you a fan? Do you realize how important that record is in the Kiss discography and
right.
First record with Eric Carr and all this shit? And anyway, it turns out he was not really wearing it. He was just wearing it.
Oh, gosh. Man. Well, whoever that
Come on,
is,
dude.
Take that. Should I? You know, one time I was, I went into
the. But I wasn't going to rip it off of his body, though.
Maybe you should have.
Well, all right.
Maybe that's going to be. Maybe that'll be a regret you have one day in life.
I'm in Las Vegas right now, but I may be able to hop on a plane and go get back to Nashville in the next 6 hours and do that.
I would venture to say that you could go down the Las Vegas Strip and find plenty of people that aren't trues to whatever shirt they're wearing.
Excuse me. Sorry to bother you. You true? Are you a true?
Excuse me. Do you actually like Nicki Minaj?
Do you have a leopard glove? Okay.
I was in my local coffee shop I go to here in Nashville called The Post, and there was someone in line one time, and I had my... my shortest straw t-shirt on, and some guy would kind of like turn around me to eye contact, and he goes, hey man, nice shirt. I was like, thanks man, thinking he's a Metallica fan. He goes, that's hilarious.
Oh no.
I immediately knew. I was just like, oh, get the fuck out of here, dude.
You fuckhead.
And
you
I did,
fucking
I,
asshole.
My only response was, what's hilarious about it? And he was like, oh, yeah. I just, you know, I thought, and I knew what exactly he was going to say, but anyways, I should have ripped his stupid fucking shirt off, whatever he was wearing.
I have a St. Anger sticker on my laptop.
Yeah, you
and
do.
There have been a few times where I've taken that out at TSA to put in, like, you have to put your computers in a separate bin.
Right.
And a TSA guy would be like, huh, like, are you a St. Anger fan? And I know that they're trues. Like, I know that they know what circles around that record, and they're really asking me. And I'm like,
sure.
Oh, you know. Anyway, back to the documentary. One of the things at this time, though, you're right. So much happened before they even made Kill 'Em All. It's crazy.
Oh, yeah. So many things that like ended up becoming like the band we know and love. You know, one of the things,
yeah, totally. Minus Cliff. I mean, this is even before Cliff, though. It's like, well, no, this is kind of swirling around Cliff era. But like, you know, this No Life Till Leather thing, the tape trading community, I mean, they were kind of underground heroes before they'd even met Johnny Z.
Oh yeah, and that local scene in LA. I mean, they you know,
well, it was LA and San Francisco,
right? Yeah,
and even like kind of East Coast. You know, Johnny Z heard the tape and brought him out, and they famously fired Ole Mustaine when they get there.
And that's a, you know, and that you know, back in those days, you know, up until maybe you know the Download era. I mean, that was a very common thing for local bands, especially in big cities like LA, San Francisco, New York, Chicago, whatever. You know, you have a tape, a CD, whatever, that's kind of circulating. Like, I mean, there was bands that I got into when growing up in Southern California that were like, I knew that nobody else knew about this band outside of my county or whatever, you know, and then all of a sudden fast forward and then all of a sudden they're getting signed and huge and stuff.
Right.
That's how it was with like, you know, we talked about this, I think, maybe it was on our Instagram live thing we did last night. I can't remember. But, you know,
that like, feels like a million years ago.
It does. It was 24 hours ago. But that, you know, similar thing to like when I was in high school and knowing that No Doubt was this local Orange County band. And then all of a sudden, you know, you have like their CD that they pressed on their own, their first record. And then all of a sudden they're just on K-Rock and blowing up. And so, yeah, similar kind of thing. Like that was, you know, No Doubt is my Metallica of the early 90s.
How bummed were you when the No Doubt cut their hair?
Oh my gosh, when Gwen cut her hair, I was just so pissed.
How bummed were you though for real when Gwen Stefani was doing all that banana shit?
Banana shit?
My bananas, B-A-N-A-N-A-S, bananas.
Oh, that stuff. I don't love her solo stuff.
It's like super pop bullshit.
It's very pop. I mean, she was kind of destined to become a pop. It's kind of like, I kind of feel like Gwen Stefani, I know we're taking a huge left turn right here, but I kind of feel like she, you know, what Taylor Swift has done recently is what Gwen Stefani did in the late 90s, early 2000s, where like No Doubt started to take a back seat and that pop girl in her really came out. But there's a lot of good solo stuff she did, man. I'll say that. I think she's a super talented girl. I just wish No Doubt could make a good record now.
She married Gavin Rossdale from Bush, who, as we all learned in the last episode, he pinned the masterpiece Glycerin, which I called and sang to a girl I wanted to date.
That's
in
right.
Middle school.
Yeah. And now she's married to country music superstar Blake Shelton.
Is she really?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, she is.
Wow. A friend of mine is dating Miranda Lambert. It's super weird.
Crazy.
Let's get back into this stuff.
I'm actually dating Taylor Swift. Don't tell my wife.
I'm dating you. You're dating Taylor Swift.
Wow. This love triangle is not going to work with this podcast, Clint. I'm sorry.
This is the Fleetwood Mac of Metallica podcasts.
Exactly. Hey, so we're talking about Behind the Music.
So Johnny Z gets the tape. See, it's hard to talk about this because we've covered a lot of this, but
we have. Yeah.
They go out to Jersey and meet up with him. They end up staying with the Anthrax boys. They were so poor, they had what Scotty Ian affectionately refers to as the loser's lunch, bologna on hand.
Bologna on hand.
They were sleeping on U-Haul blankets. Firing old Dave Shitstain, get Kirk Hammett in there. They said the first song they played was Seek and Destroy. I love that image.
Oh, I know.
So the thing, dude, I think we've said it before, but it's so weird that the beginning of Seek and Destroy, they're both playing that intro together from the top.
And they still do it.
That's how that song goes.
Oh yeah, that's just how it is.
Like if you and I were producing that, we'd be like, "All right, James, you do the first two bars."
Yeah, then when Lars does the build up, then right. Kirk, you come in. Yeah, yeah, just to add some dynamic range to it, you know.
But that's kind of how they did a lot of like Four Horsemen's that way and Hit the Lights is that way. Yeah. It's like for that one song, they were like, "Let's just do something different and just rip it from the top."
Dude, Master of Puppets is that way. When they play Puppets Live to this day, like both Kirk and James are doing.
Is that true?
Yeah, go watch any clip of them playing that. I'm positive.
You sure Kirk's not just going down to down to down?
Positive. Dude, Outlaw Torn is on S&M.
Should I look this up right now?
I promise you, whenever they play it, I've always noticed that. I'm like, why are they both playing it? Why isn't Kirk just going, you know, down to down to down down?
Would you say that the cunning stunts would be a fair, if I look at the Cunning Stunts version?
Sure, why not? I can't confirm or deny it off the top of my head, but everything I've looked up, even when we saw them in Detroit and I saw them in Philly, I remember them doing it. There you go.
Oh, this is the yo-yo-yo crap.
Yo-yo-yo-yo-yo-yo-yo!
Man, I love Cunning Stunts. Lars is laying down in his kit. James is so proud of himself. Wow. This witty stage banter to end all witty stage banter. All right, let me look here. But you're talking about the spider riff, not this intro, right?
No, I'm talking about like that part right there. Are they doing it separately?
It's not showing Kirk yet. You're talking about the spider riff right here, right?
I'm talking about like the main.
You're talking about the dun dun dun. Yeah, they didn't show Kirk, and I don't want to look anymore.
Well, just take my word for it.
Dude, I wanted to insert a clip here at 15:30. I love Young James. They just made Kill 'Em All, and it's James at that show. We got our new album, Kill 'Em All.
We have a debut album out on Megaforce Records. It's called Kill 'Em All. We're glad to kill all you tonight. Who wants
We're going to kill all of you
We're
tonight.
Kill all of you tonight. Who wants I'd this, man?
I'd love to see like full video of that show.
I know, man. Well, there's a lot of great footage of them in those early days that you can watch a couple full shows, but that one in particular where they're so excited about their new record, he's holding up the vinyl, and I think he kind of throws in the crowd. He's like, "Who wants this?"
Right. Imagine that whoever has that one.
Oh, man. It was probably Mustaine. He was probably in the front row just going, "Oh, man. Man.
Well, yeah, I am. I want it. Kurt played all my solos.
He ripped me off." Can you imagine if Dave Mustaine had Twitter back then?
Oh my God! What was the version of Twitter back then? Like Dear Abby, like writing into like a
right,
like an op-ed local newspaper diary.
Exactly. Well,
Dear Abby, my former band's been really
this guy from Exodus took my job.
My former band's been really mean to me lately. Bunch of buttheads.
They don't like when I drink too much. Oh.
Apparently, I get a little too violent.
I can't remember, but they don't have any proof because the iPhones haven't been invented yet.
Yeah. Me and Doc Holliday are making a time machine, right? Doc Holliday. Doc Holliday.
Dr. Emmett Brown.
Me and Dr. Emmett Brown are going to go meet Doc Holliday in a time machine.
We're going to make the Old West. Buford Mad Dog Mustaine.
Oh my God, the Back to the Future 3 Metallica crossover.
That would be amazing.
So then.
Well, what are you looking at, butthead?
Pepsi free.
Hey, Kirk, why don't you make like a tree and get out of here?
Nah, it's make like a tree and leave. You sound like a butthead when you say it that way. George McFly, you know the man who took his life and flushed it completely down the toilet? Nice story.
Nice. Tell it to the USA Today. That's a part two reference with Martin.
Tell it to the hoverboard.
Tell it to the DeLorean.
Tell it to the DeLorean.
Tell it to Strickland.
Yeah, slacker. You're gonna wind up in detention.
Oh my gosh. I think we might need an episode of Dave Mustaine watching Back to the Future trilogy.
Oh my God. I'm so glad that just happened.
Hey, you heard her. Get your meat hooks off of her.
Yeah, want to go to the Enchantment by the Sea under the sea dance? Earth Angel, will you be mine?
You know that you know sound you've been looking for? Well, listen to Symphony of Destruction.
Hey, Marvin, it's me, your cousin, Dave Mustaine.
Oh, we're so close to church giggle world.
I could
quote Back to the Future in Mustaine voice all night long.
Well, that's your name, isn't it, Calvin Klein?
Oh my, we're even getting Leah Thompson involved, dude. I know. Who would have thought we'd come close to church giggles and not even be in the same room?
127 gigawatts.
And, actually, it's 1.21.
Oh,
who's president in 1985?
Ronald Reagan.
The actor? Who's vice president? Jerry Lewis? I feel like my Mustaine voice is getting worse and worse. Good night, future boy.
Nobody calls me chicken. Oh, Jesus.
Oh, my gosh.
I'm crying.
Me too. Oh, this is something we have to develop, Clint.
Jesus.
Oh, anyways, where were we? I guess the documentary is over. That's our episode, everybody.
Okay, let me try to find where I'm at my notes. They make lightning. This is when they talk about the press calling them Alcoholica, which we've said this before, but if you're getting fired from a band nicknamed Alcoholica because you drink too much, you are an asshole.
Chances are you don't deserve to be in that band.
they talk about the Ozzy tour.
It's kind of like Steven Adler getting kicked out of Guns N' Roses for doing too many drugs.
Yeah, totally. You got Izzy and / both heroin, straight up heroin junkies.
Yeah, and they're like, Steven's got to go.
Steven, it's too much from this guy. They talk about the Ozzy tour, and there's actually a clip of Ozzy saying that, you know, they gave him a run for his money every night. He said they were a very hard act to follow. I thought that was pretty cool.
Very cool.
They really give me a run for my money every night. The crowd was going nuts for him, you know, stealing the show most of the night. They were really hard to follow.
That's a great moment in this documentary is you see footage of them, you know, at this point they're on the Master of Puppets tour. They're like great cross setup, and of course the backdrop that our friend Wayne returned. But yeah, I mean, like at that point, Ozzy is, you know, pushing what, 25 years into his career at this point with Black Sabbath, and then now doing solo stuff, and he's huge. And
yeah,
was that the Blizzard of Oz tour? I can't remember.
I don't remember.
Let's just say it was the Paranoid tour.
Yeah, it was obviously Masters of Reality.
Exactly.
Oh, what are we talking? 1986. Actually, it was definitely self-titled debut. Yeah.
It was the Heaven and Hell tour, even though Ozzy was in it.
They picked us up in like this kind of like limousine Sprinter today from the airport.
Yeah,
blasting Holy Diver.
Holy Diver, nice.
Just blasting it.
Some
of the guys I were with were kind of like, "Oh, what?" I was like, "Don't you fucking say a word! Your fucking mouth."
Dio's great, man.
After the Ozzy tour, this is when they kind of talk about the excesses of the road, and it's just weird because, on the one hand, I get it. It's a nice thing that you're fucking a lot of chicks because you're in Metallica. They talk about coming off stage and not like eight chicks are bathing them and I guess sucking and fucking them or whatever.
Right, yeah.
But it's just weird to see him brag about it. Like, because it's like, dudes, I don't know. This is keep that shit on the down low, man.
I mean, I guess, you know.
It's
not that cool, but if this were like a, like I said earlier, like a 4-hour Tom Petty type documentary where you're just, there's no holds barred. You are just talking about everything. Like,
then, all right, let's have it. Yeah.
It, you know. But now here's what we probably have to understand too is that I'm imagining that when VH1 approached them to do this and they were filming everyone's interviews, I guarantee they probably had enough content to cover 4 hours, but they got to consolidate it down to 44 minutes or whatever.
Right, and I guess that's juicy information.
Exactly. I think for the VH1 audience back then, it's like, oh my gosh, you walked off stage and had girls bathing you? That's so cool, you know? So it's almost like back then it was like the same thing as like clickbait, you know? Because you show that clip of James talking about getting bathed by women in the bathroom or in the shower right before you go to commercial, and you're like, oh my gosh, I gotta stick around and watch the rest of this, you know?
Well, since we've mentioned that Tom Petty doc, you know, you're right. That's like 4 hours, or it's like 3 hours plus a concert DVD. But yeah. and you know those dudes were fucking on the road, but there's no mention of that. It's like right. Yeah, it's all about the music and the band. I prefer
right
to,
exactly.
Like it doesn't bother me. I'm not a prude about it. Have fun, do what you want, experiment with all sorts of different STDs. But just it's weird to see it in a 45-minute documentary that should really be about, you know, behind the music, not them fucking chicks, but behind the music. What were their lives like? I don't know. I guess that's what their lives were like.
No, their lives were definitely like that back then. But I mean, also, you know, however much interview footage they had of all the guys consolidated into 44, 45 minutes, it's essentially like a best of Metallica's history in that short amount of time.
So, but them fucking chicks just isn't important to me as a fan.
Not to me, but I mean, I'm imagining VH1 is trying to, you know, reach more than just Metallica fans.
Yeah.
They're trying to reach Poison fans.
And pornographers.
And, you know, if I was there, you know, if I had happened to walk in the room while, you know, those dudes were getting bathed down, I would say, hey, you get your damn hands off her.
Oh, man. George Mustaine McFly. The hero.
Hey, Lou, I'll take a milkshake. Chocolate.
I'm your density. Destiny.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, we're about to make what's called a hard segue here, because unfortunately the next thing that we talk about is Cliff's death. So let's go ahead and just hear this whole clip. Let's insert, make a marker and insert that here. And
yeah.
Let's hear from the boys about Cliff.
On September 27th, 1986, the band was traveling by bus on the road between Stockholm and Copenhagen.
On that European tour, you know, we had a really bad bus.
These particular buses weren't purpose-built that we have now. They have normal windows like a passenger coach, and the bunks are just bolted in. Then they put cardboard over the windows.
Earlier that night, a friendly dispute between Kirk and Cliff over sleeping arrangements concluded with a draw of cards.
The first card that Cliff picked was the Ace of Spades, and he looked at me and said, I want your bunk. And I said, fine, take my bunk, I'll sleep up front. That's probably better anyway, you know. Later on that night, at about 5 or 6 in the morning, I heard a skidding, I heard a vibration, and then this motion. I thought we were going off a cliff.
He overcorrected to get back onto the road, and as he did, the back end came around this way, and it started chomp, chomp, chomp.
It's the sound of screeching brakes and being flipped around like a piece of clothes in a dryer.
Scott woke up, like hot coffee getting poured all over me, you know, from the coffee machine, and, you know, the bus was on its side.
What happened? Is the bus gonna blow up?
Well, I jumped out of the bus, took off, did the 100-yard dash in about 7 seconds flat.
And we're standing out there in our underwear and, you know, 10 below.
And I heard everyone screaming except for Cliff. And I thought, oh my God, something's wrong.
Seeing the bus driver just, you know, freaking frantic.
And I turned around and I saw Cliff's leg sticking out from underneath the bus.
I went to, you know, pull him out, wake him up or whatever. It's like, you know, he's not moving.
And the driver walked over and started pulling on the blanket that was underneath the bus next to Cliff. And I said, what are you doing?
I grabbed him and said, don't you take that away from him.
Against all odds, the band hoped that somehow, some way, Cliff could be saved.
A crane turned up, a big crane with a jib and all that, and they hooked up a chain around the bus, and they picked the bus up.
There's still people trapped under the bus, but everyone else is okay.
I don't know if Cliff was dead at this point or not, because the bus actually slipped back after they picked it up. They lifted it to pull him out, and it slipped back and landed again on the floor.
After that, I was in such shock that everything else for the next 3 or 4 hours, I can't even remember.
Kirk and James yelling at the driver.
What did you do? What did you do?
What happened? You know, what's going on? You know, is this guy drunk or la la la? Oh, we hit some black ice. And I recall in my underwear, you know, and socks, walking for miles, looking for this black ice, walking back on. Where's this black ice? I don't see any black ice. And I wanted to kill this guy. I was gonna end him there.
Early Saturday morning, September 27th, 1986, on the road near Ljungby, Sweden, Cliff Burton died. He was 24 years old.
He just got thrown out the window and boom, the bus landed on him. And basically, by all accounts, I mean, he never woke up.
You know, to this day, I just think, you know, it could have been me, it couldn't have been me, but it's never left me to this day.
You always feel protected on tour. Nothing bad can happen like this. It's not allowed. You know what I mean? This is rock and roll, man. Nobody dies, but they do. And it had happened, and it was hard to grasp that.
Drinkers we were, we went back to the hotel and just drank.
Obviously, we all know the story about Cliff's death, you know, in the bus crash in Copenhagen, and, you know, him and, you know, the boys drew straws to see who got the best bunk, and you know, Kirk was supposed to have that bunk originally, whatever.
Well, they drew cards. And
the card, not straws.
The card that Cliff drew was the Ace of Spades.
Right, yeah. Yeah, and he takes Kirk's bunks. You know, he's like, you know, there's that interview footage of Kirk where he's like, I want your bunk, you know, and it's just, you know, as much as we've heard the story and stuff, it's still weird to watch that, you know, because it's like, man, these dudes were like a band of brothers at this point, you know, three records right. in, getting great tour opportunities, you know, on tour with Anthrax in Europe and, you know, no one ever expects when you go on the road for a tragedy to strike like that.
No.
And you lose one of your brothers so in an instant, you know.
And they were all integral. I don't think anyone was more so than the other, but Cliff was, unusually for a bass player, a very big part of, especially with Lightning and Puppets, what was kind of becoming harmonically and musically special about them.
Right, yeah.
Setting them apart from, you know, 85 and 86 were really big years for thrash metal, Slayer,
yeah,
with Anthrax, even Megadeth. But they pulled away for reasons we've talked about a lot before, but I think a lot of that was grounded in what Cliff brought to the table musically.
Right, exactly, yeah.
So it just takes on all sorts of additional tragic undertones.
Oh, yeah.
And then, of course, we hear about the grueling audition process, and there were 40 dudes. The boys were drinking the whole time because they were grieving, and one dude would fly all the way there from across the world and get told to go home because he looked weird. Or
yeah. I mean, these dudes were, you know, these guys didn't want to replace Cliff, even though they had to. And as right. we've learned through other resources and stuff, you know, it was, you know, other people had to talk them into remaining a band and stuff. They don't really go into a lot of that in the behind the music, but you know, I mean, these dudes are completely fucked up, getting hammered every day, doing auditions. Jason was what, the last one to audition?
Yeah.
It's like, I'm sure at that point they were probably like, I often wonder, like, whoever the last guy would have been if it wasn't Jason, would they have just hired that guy? Where they're like, okay, whatever, it's the last dude, let's just hire him, we don't care.
It does, because what I heard, what he said before is that he was the first one there, but the last to audition.
Right.
And he was just sort of hanging around. And he had gotten one of their set lists and kind of learned the whole set, and they were pretty impressed by that. But yeah, it's like out of 40 guys, like I've been parts of auditions before, and if you find the right guy before the 40, you're not getting to the 40th guy.
Right, yeah, exactly.
So they really must just, I don't think it was out of desperation. I think Jason obviously was the right guy for the next 14 years.
I agree,
but
yeah.
If they had found another Cliff or Jason at guy 26, they're not going all the way to fucking 40, unless their management made them or something.
That's the only thing I can think of is that management, you know, Cliff Bernstein or whatever, you know, those management and probably their label and stuff had already kind of like pushed them back up on their feet. Like, look, you guys have to move forward. Cliff would have wanted it. You know, we need to do auditions. We got shows booked, blah, blah, blah. So even if...
They had that whole Japanese tour. That's
right.
That was Jason's first thing.
Budokan. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And so I'd imagine if they were like, you know, at, you know, guy 31 or whatever, it's like, that guy was great. He's awesome. We like him. You know, Cliff Bernstein and them are like, well, let's just get... We have 9 guys left. Let's just get through them for the rest of the day, and then we can make a decision, you know. But
I wonder who some of those dudes were. I know we know Les Claypool. But
yeah, Les Claypool, obviously.
I wonder if it was any other famous cats.
Probably Geddy Lee.
right. Roger Waters, of course.
Roger Waters was for sure there.
Paul McCartney.
John Paul Jones. Yeah.
John Entwistle,
yeah,
for sure.
Flea.
Geezer Butler. Flea.
Geezer Butler, yeah. For sure was there, yeah. Steve Harris.
I had a guy tell me recently he did not like the Red Hot Chili Peppers, which is totally fine.
Right.
I said, well, what is it about it you don't like? And he said, the bass playing. Mm. And I said, well, you're saying you don't like them for the thing that they are worldwide famous for at being badass at. So,
right.
Maybe keep that on the inside.
Yeah, or
inside
maybe just lie and say Anthony Kiedis's vocals or something. I mean, I'm a big Chili Peppers fan, but like
me too.
I mean, I grew up with that stuff, but
it was a pretty funny conversation because he goes, man, were you ever a Chili Peppers fan? And I said, I'm currently a Chili Peppers fan. And he's like, what is it you like about him? I was like, just no one's ever asked me that, you know? I was like,
yeah.
Well, the musicianship, the songs, the humor, they're badass, they're amazing. Their records sound great and are important, and they changed the whole genre of music. And what's not to like about the fucking Chili Peppers? I even like the One Hot Minute record with Dave Navarro.
Yeah, and that's not a great record, but it's still there's
Dude,
great songs
that song
on
Aeroplane
there.
Is awesome.
Oh, Aeroplane's great. I mean, there's yeah,
My
totally.
Friends is on that record.
My Friends is on that record. What's the song I'm thinking of? That's crap.
Hold on, let me guess what the song is you're thinking of. Hold on.
Can you guess it?
I'm thinking of something. Can you guess?
I think I can.
Let me look at the... Here we go. Track list right here. Warped, Deep Kick, Coffee Shop, Shallow Be Thy Game, P, One Big Mob, Walkabout, Tearjerker, One Hot Minute, Falling Into Grace, Transcending. Is it Warped?
What a big fan I am. I'm trying to remember. Oh, you know what? I'm thinking of the song. It was pre One Hot Minute, after John Frusciante left, before Navarro came in. I believe Flea actually played guitar on it. It's
are we talking about
the Conehead yeah, soundtrack?
You're talking about a Soul to Squeeze.
Soul to Squeeze. That is.
Will I go? I just don't know.
Yeah, that's a great song.
That's actually a song where one of the lyrics is "Ching chang chong chong chang chang chong chong chang chang."
Which most people don't know this, but Anthony Kiedis was actually trying to sing the lyrics to Bread Fan right there.
Bread Fan, chang chang chong chang chang, lose it.
Oh man!
All right, now then, Jason's new in the band, famously heckled and hazed. They actually talk about it. Let's hear from the boys about the hazing process.
All right,
but soon after that was the hazing.
We gave him a pretty tough time because we didn't want him to think that he just like waltzed into a perfect situation, you know?
And then when a period of calm hits, that's when the reality starts setting in. And then all of a sudden all hell breaks loose. And then the emotions start coming out.
You know, I hate to say this, but Jason became the scapegoat for you know, the tragic loss that we had just experienced with Cliff.
With the specter of Cliff Burton's death hanging over the band, they embark for Japan in the fall of 1986. But for Metallica and their new bass player, the transition was a hard one.
We were all trying to see his boiling point, you know, or how much he can take, you know.
We told everyone he was gay. We'd go out to a hotel bar and like buy drinks for everyone and charge it to Jason's room.
And then we went to sushi that night. Jace, that green stuff, it's mint sauce. Put some of that, you'll love it. Wasabi. But he kept walking into every single landmine and every single trap we set for him. And that just made it more and more fun.
Part of loving him means that he has to accept us for who we are, which is not easy.
I mean, everyone thinks, wow, this guy's landed the greatest gig, etc. On the one hand, yes, but on the other hand, think of all the baggage that he's got to plow through. Plus, he's got those three.
So they're talking about, they're trying to see what his boiling point was. And...
Right. I mean, I obviously, I don't necessarily agree with them doing all this shit to Jason. And, we came to learn later that, like, I don't know if it was part of his hazing process, but, I mean, the first year he was in the band, he was only making, like, $500 a week.
Well, yeah, they were just treating him like a hired gun.
Which is crazy. I mean, they're already a pretty massive band at this point in the metal scene, selling out almost everywhere they go. And right. He's making $500 a week.
Right.
That's why he wanted to make those sandwiches, man.
Yeah. He's making the sandwiches during the Black Album because that's how he lived for 3 years.
Exactly.
That's all he knew.
Right.
Rex Brown, I'm reading Rex Brown's book, and he talks about how one of the things that the Metallica boys did often while partying at strip clubs and shit is they'd run up these big tabs and they would just point to someone and be like, all right, you're covering the tab.
Yeah, it's on
and,
his.
He talks about how, like, during the kind of Cowboy from Hell days, Pantera was sort of starting to take off, but he's like, dude, we didn't have any money. We could hardly buy a pack of cigarettes.
Right.
And these motherfuckers were doing Injustice for All and, you know, getting nominated for Grammys and shit.
Yeah. Selling They're like, hey, this tab, this, you see that guy over there, the bass player of Pantera, Rex Brown? Yeah, he's covering this.
Speaking of justice, here's the only sentence said about Injustice for All. Justice was a progressive, frenzied album that pronounced the death of the American dream. And then you're right on to Bob Rock and the Black Album.
Yeah.
Like, wow, they didn't even mention like they made their first video and got nominated for a Grammy. I mean, just glossed right over that shit.
Oh yeah.
No, they had to have the 2.5 minutes of them talking about fucking chicks. So sorry, we can't talk about, you know, what was going on behind the music and why they were ascending to legendary status.
Yeah, we can't talk about one of our, you know,
we got to hear about them watching James Hetfield's Ding Dong.
Yeah,
I called it a ding dong.
I think ding dong is a great word.
James Hetfield washed his ding dong.
Well, he didn't wash it. A bunch of show whores washed his ding dong for him.
And hopefully they were this many so he wouldn't go to jail.
Mom, what does it mean when adults hug each other naked?
Oh,
they're naked and hugging.
They're just taking a shower. It's okay.
They just want to be clean. They're conserving water.
That's right. Have you heard about the water crisis in California, son?
Have you heard about the ding-dong crisis?
Okay. All right, we got Bob Rock. Bob Rock talking about how they were a great live band, and you know he thought that no one had captured their live energy but with a great-sounding record, and I think that might be true, maybe. I think, I don't know. There's a bigness to the Black Album that doesn't translate as much on Puppets, or definitely not on Justice, but Lightning or Puppets.
Oh yeah, well, especially if you hear live versions of the Black Album, you know, much like the Binge and Purge era, that early '90s era. I mean, God, their live sound back then, in comparison to the Black Album, was, I mean, pretty close to what was on record, but you know, obviously more energy because it's live, and there's a thousand million trillion people there.
It's a great headline.
It's a real number, by the way.
Oh, yeah, totally. Hold on. Let me just added that up. That's correct. That was
great. Yeah, okay. I figured. Okay.
There's a really great headline they show. I think it was them on the cover of some magazine. And it says, I wrote it down. It says, Metallica didn't go to number one. Number one came to them. I thought that was pretty cool.
I think that's accurate. I mean, you know, obviously, as we've talked about before, Metallica's gotten shit for quote unquote selling out and this and that, you know, but I mean,
These and those,
you know, who
Dems
does
and D's.
Who does that, you know? But it's true, though. I think number one came.
Did they?
But I think it's right. I mean, I think number one came to them. I think even if they kind of continued on and making like something else that was similar to Puppets or Justice, I think their momentum was so strong before the Black Album came out that I think number one would have still come to them. It just happened to be a much bigger, more gigantic number one in this case.
Yeah. It's such a swirling cauldron, if you will, witch's cauldron of
the
them
Black
getting,
Cauldron.
Them having momentum from being a live band, grassroots, underground. But in addition to that, their songwriting really reaching a sort of apex.
Oh, yeah.
Just the timing, you know, like... Imagine if, like, somehow Seek and Destroy became a huge thing, and they toured it for 2 years instead of 8 months before they made Lightning, and then they were catapulted into that level of success, and all they really had was Lightning level, which that's no shit. There's so many classics on that record, but
right,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like,
oh yeah,
it just that 10 years of hard work culminated in such a perfect storm, known as the Black Album,
known as TBA.
They talk about the Guns tour. That's all very interesting shit. Learning how not to be in a band.
Oh yeah, totally. I love. There's a moment. I think during the there's a lot of great stuff during the Guns tour footage. But one being like Spinal Tap giving them shit for the Black Album cover.
Oh yeah,
that was always great. I mean, as a fan of Christopher Guest movies and Spinal Tap specifically, I love
that's
that.
That's a Rob Reiner movie.
Yeah. Well, Christopher Guest wrote the songs and blah blah blah.
Yeah, yeah.
But
Big
yeah.
Bottom.
Talk about mud flaps.
Mud flaps, Michael's got. I like working on a sex farm.
Oh, sex farm, yeah. Getting out my pitchfork, poking at your hay. That's a genius. If you're listening to this podcast and you haven't seen Spinal Tap, you need to hit pause right now and go watch it, download it, whatever you have to do. It's a genius movie.
And watch it. So watch it the first time. Then watch it with a commentary. It's like a whole other movie.
Oh, yeah, it's great. And I mean, the fact that you know, Rob Reiner, Christopher Guest, Harry Shearer, and Michael McKean made this movie, and it, I mean, in 84, I mean, what they kind of cover in this movie, and for those of you who don't know about, you know, a lot of movies that Christopher Guest has done or is in, they're all
kind of parody type.
Yeah, they're quote-unquote mockumentaries, which I know he hates that term, but... But it's great. I mean, the stuff that they are kind of poking fun at still goes on to this day. And this was in the early 80s.
Dude, if I'm still playing in a venue and it's like kind of a big, weird venue where we can't find whatever, I will still say, hello, Cleveland.
Hello, Cleveland. Like, and then you encounter B.B. King backstage and he's like, what you want to do is go this way. And
right.
Wasn't that B.B. King in the movie? Yeah.
I don't think that was B.B. King, was it?
I thought it was.
I know Billy Crystal was the mime.
Billy Crystal and Dana Carvey.
And Dana Carvey, yeah.
Yeah.
One of the best scenes is when, who's that? What's that guy's name when they're in the limo and he's talking about Frank Sinatra, and they just slowly roll the window on him.
Bruno Kirby.
Bruno Kirby. Bruno Kirby. Yeah, and he's like, these fucking punks don't get it. He's like, when you've lived and loved the way Frank has.
When you've loved the way Frank or lived the way Frank has.
They just slowly roll that window up. It's amazing. Oh, so, all right, I wanted to camp out here because I think our listeners know, and I think many of our listeners share this, but you and I are massive Guns fans.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And so this intersection of our two of our, you know, most favorite bands of all time is such a fascinating point in history. Guns are on their massively successful Use Your Illusions tour. Metallica's on their massively successful Wherever We May Roam tour. The brass at the top have the genius, and I'm using the word genius sincerely, genius idea to, for a few months, put those two motherfuckers together on a co-headline.
Right.
And just rake in money. But a sort of sore spot of being a Guns fan is they have a really bad reputation at that time of being difficult, conceited, blowhard dickheads.
Right, yeah.
And apparently the tour was just sort of, we're going to do a whole episode on that tour, but riddled with difficulty and ego clashing. And the famous night that James Hetfield in Montreal steps into some pyro, gets burned up, has to be rushed to the hospital, ends their set. Axl and co. come out for a little bit. Axl starts bitching about his voice and the monitors, and then pulls the plug, takes the boys off the deck.
Right,
and then a fucking riot breaks out. And the riot was so intense that they couldn't even leave the venue, which must have been really terrifying, by the way.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you have to imagine, too, in an arena, you know, it's not like the backstage is, like, locked down like a fucking castle.
No, they're like locker rooms.
Locker rooms and like, you know, pretty much on the side of the stage, you just have, like, pipe and drape. It's just, like, right. Curtains somebody can run right through, you know?
I mean, there's a lot of concrete, but, yeah.
But they're just back there with Slash on it, with a towel on his head, just, like, just got out of the shower. Well, just shooting Jason the shit.
It was Kirk who said that they were just acting like nothing had happened.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Axel's on a rocket ship to the space and totally. Back to the next city.
Yeah, he's got Michael Jackson's old rocket ship from the Bad Tour.
Exactly.
And he's like Rocket Man in his spare time.
Right.
And have you ever seen that video on YouTube of James Hetfield reading Guns N' Roses' backstage writer?
Oh, it's great. He's got little cubes of cheese. Make him sing like this.
Yeah, so he doesn't get him. He talks about it so they don't get stuck. Or he talks about them getting stuck in his little tiny throat.
Yeah.
He talks about that there's a bed on the writer.
Yeah.
He's like, a bed? What is he doing? Sleeping before the gig? Like,
well, what's funny is there's definitely clips of Hetfield doing that. And Slash is in the background laughing.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, there's points where he's making fun of Axl, and Slash is just sitting there like, whatever, totally. I get it. I'm in the band with him.
Man, that burn, when James gets burned and you can actually hear the strings pop off the guitar.
Oh, yeah. It's like this crazy sound.
Because you can hear it. He's playing Fade to Black, so he's got that kind of clean, chorusy delay James tone that I personally love a
right.
lot.
Right. It sounds like just took like robot tuners on his guitar and detuned them all at the same time.
Right. Yeah, they get slinky and or turned them up, or like, you know, it sounds like they pop because they melt.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, it was. I remember being in high school, like reading about that in like Rip magazine or Hit Parade or something. Just like, you know, I found out about it either that or maybe I saw it on MTV News with Kurt Loder or something. But
oh yeah, or Tabitha Soren.
Tabitha Soren. Around. I like Tabitha. I know
you and Moke share an affinity for her. I never was in. You know who I thought was attractive was Kennedy.
Oh, Kennedy was totally a cutie. Kennedy, total the babe. Cutie. What about Duff?
Duff McKagan?
Not McKagan. Remember Duff was the other girl on MTV. She was kind of like she was very like early '90s alternative looking. Like maybe wore like a collar around her neck and had like black hair.
I'm looking her up right now.
Duff. One of my favorites was Serena Ultral.
I don't remember her either, I don't
think. She was an MTV News babe. You don't remember Duff?
I'm looking her up Duffy, right now, man.
I think her last name was Duffy, maybe.
Duff Duffy?
No, like Duff Duffy.
Karen Duffy.
Karen Duffy, that's it, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's
babe. Like, she looks like a Latin babe. My wife's Puerto Rican.
If she were president, she'd be Abraham Lincoln. So I'm going back to Wayne's World now.
Yeah, I know. I think James if we Dane, do any does all of our favorite movies.
If we do movie reviews on this podcast at some point, it should all be in maybe Mustaine and Torben review movies.
Dude, Dave Mustaine does Coming to America.
Good morning, my neighbors.
Hey, fuck you.
Yeah, fuck you too.
Oh my God.
You see, I love the Lord. If loving the Lord's wrong, I don't want to be right. Sexual chocolate.
Randy Watson.
You know, just for fun, can we just put the whole Randy Watson clip in right now?
Of course.
I got a special treat for you this evening. A young man that you all know is Joe the Policeman from the What's Going Down episode of That's My Mama. I want you to put your hands together and welcome him to the stage. Big round of applause for Jackson Heights' own Mr. Randy Watson. Yes, Randy Watson.
That boy is good.
Mm-hmm. Good and terrible. And Reverend Brown, 3 years for the Reverend. This man's been my Reverend since I was a little boy, and I love him dearly. You're a very special man. Reverend Brown. Reverend Brown. It feels so lovely to be here tonight. What a beautiful audience. Give yourselves a round of applause. You're so lovely. Everyone's so lovely. And while you're in the clapping mood, I'd like to give a big round of applause to my band, Sexual Chocolate. Sexual Chocolate. They play so fine, don't you agree?
I believe the children are our future.
Thank you.
Teach them well and let them lead the way. Show them all the beauty they possess inside. Give them a sense of pride. Make it easier.
I believe Randy children Watson. Are our future. I love that shit.
I believe the children of our future. Thank you very much.
What was this other... That boy good.
That boy's good.
Yeah, good, terrible. What was this other MTV VJ you said?
Serena.
Not Karen Duffy.
Serena Ultra, I think her last name was.
Oh, good just, God, how do you spell
it? I would just type in that? Serena UL, and then it'll probably pop up. Under, Google knows what I'm talking about.
MTV VJ.
Serena.
Video jockeys.
Video jockeys.
Oh, yeah. No, she's too Swedish looking or something.
She probably is. I think she was a babe. Serena, if you're listening, I'm definitely not available, but we can go to coffee or something.
Remember that guy Jesse? I'm seeing pictures of him.
Jesse,
fucking junkie.
He totally was. He looked like a heroin addict. I think he's still alive, surprisingly. Me and my wife went down this rabbit hole one night of looking up old, VJs like Adam Curry and stuff. And Adam Curry was awesome because he was like the metal guy.
Yeah, I remember him. He kind of wore like a black T-shirt.
Yeah, that or a black leather jacket. He kind of had like Appetite for Destruction, Steven Adler hair.
Yeah.
He was cool.
Well, of course, then he cut it, though. He cut it later.
Yeah, of course, Ricky Rackman doing Headbangers Ball was always a treat. Ed Lover, Yo MTV Raps. Come on.
We got to get out of here.
What, the MTV world?
we got to get out of this episode.
All right, let's wrap it up. We're not far from the end, folks. Of course, we get into John Marshall filling in on guitar, and they interview him a little bit.
Which he saved the day. You know, he saved the day a few times. He saved the day on the Aussie tour when James broke his arm fucking skateboarding.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you, John Marshall. I'm sure they would have gotten somebody else just fine, but you know what, kids? If you're a guitar tech, it pays to learn the band you work for.
And James
songs.
Even says that. But, you know, but he was playing in metal church. I mean, the dude knew how to play.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, he was no slouch. He wasn't like, I only know how to tune and play two chords. No, he was a great guitar player.
Our bass player, Blake, just came in. Say, hey, Blake.
Hey, what's up?
Hey, Blake.
You're talking to tens of thousands of Metallica fans.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, my goodness, man. Awesome. Tell you what,
man. They just went shopping for clothes at All Saints.
Super fancy, man. Oh, that cheap store.
Cool shit?
Did you buy any sewing machines in the front window?
Apparently, there's an outlet here, so they got them for reasonable prices.
Isn't that the store that the whole front is like all sewing machines or something like that?
He said, isn't the front where they have all sewing machines? The front of the store? Yes. Really?
Am I correct?
I thought you were joking. He says yes. No, he says
yes.
Not this one because it's the outlet.
Not this one because it was an outlet.
Oh, it's the outlet. Okay. Well, Got to get them nice clothes for the country music award thing you're doing.
We probably got like 20 more minutes. Is that cool?
Yeah, dude. I'm gonna.
What do you need to do?
Thought about showering.
You can shower. Yeah.
Can we go? Can we take a trip into the shower?
Keep the water running warm. I'll be in there in a minute, homie.
Hey, I think Clint. I think our audience would like if you could recreate this scene where James is talking about going into the shower and getting washed with your friend Blake.
Yeah.
There,
that's what we do in our country bands. Is
I figured.
We
yeah,
we don't have as many chicks, so we just have to make do with our
shower holica.
So. They go on a, they call it a break, but I don't know how much of a break it was from 94 to, because they started making Load in 95. But this is when they talk about Lars pursued scuba and art, Kirk pursued spirituality, James went hunting, all that shit.
Yeah,
they show a little bit of the making of Load and Reload. But at this point, these are kind of their newish records.
Right, yeah.
They do address their image, and I did want to insert a clip here. Let's hear from the boys about their image change.
I can understand, like, this kid has the photo from 1991 from the Black Album. That's my Metallica. The next photo he sees is 5 years later, and it's on this other record that has semen on the cover. And these guys on the back in Cuban pimp suits with martinis and cigars and no hair. Who is that? It says Metallica on there, but I don't recognize these people.
When they're doing the Unplugged in New York, they all showed up, all four of the guys. They're all sitting in a row, and they all have these new short haircuts and stuff. It was pretty funny. So Mike wrote some stuff on his bass about friends not letting friends get friends' haircuts, because they were all GQ looking and cleaned up and stuff.
Metallica is all about music, not the length of our hair.
We've heard the word sell out, you know, from way back.
Nowadays, I welcome it. Come with me with what you got.
Yes, we sell out every seat in the house, every time we play, anywhere we play.
Friends don't let friends give friends haircuts.
Yeah, it's interesting because, of course, I mean, I'm a huge Alice fan, but Jerry Cantrell's fucking making fun of him, even in this Behind the Music.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like, what did he... Go look a picture of Jerry Cantrell right now. Guess what his hair looks like?
Well,
it's short.
It's technically long again, but it was short for when I went and saw Alice in Chains.
Is it really?
It is long again, yeah. When I went and saw Alice in Chains at the Ryman a couple years ago, it was short and it was like kind of weird, but it, hey, you know? And guess what? Back then, dude, your singer was Lane Staley, and guess what he had? Short hair.
Yeah, totally. Which Lane did have long hair, like right during a little bit before facelift.
Oh, he had long hair. If you look, the original like Man in the Box video has long hair, and he cut that shit off. So guess what, Jerry?
Yeah, Jerry. Wow. I'm looking at pictures of 2018 Jerry Cantrell, and you're correct. He has a beard and long hair.
Yeah, he looks bitchin'.
Wow. I always thought Jerry Cantrell looked good.
He's
cool.
Awesome. He's one of my favorite guitarists of that 90s, quote-unquote, grunge alternative era.
Sorry, we're going to a... Our record label is throwing a party for us tonight, and we're going to this thing later, and the guys want to come into my room and pregame it. And you know what I told them? I said, not right now. Because
I'm recording podcast cold.
Because I'm dedicated to all of our fans who I love very much, and I'm dedicated to continuing to quote Back to the Future 1, 2, and 3 via the voice of Dave Mustaine.
I really wish you were about to tell me that the other guys in your band wanted to come in and get ready in your room. Like, guys, let's all get ready together.
That there will be none of that.
Well, you can. Well, that way, I mean, listen, you're just making sure that no one's going to wear the same outfit.
One of the things Kirk says, and he kind of lays it out, and it's a really simple statement, but it does wrap it up. He's like, you know, Metallica is not about how long our fucking hair is. It's about the music.
And right. Agreed. Of course.
I've always felt that way. I could not have given a fuck that they looked different or cut their hair. I couldn't give a fuck. You know what I gave a fuck about? That King Nothing sounded badass.
Yeah, that they still kicked ass. The only people that care about that stuff nowadays are people that comment on YouTube.
And Lars actually talks, they're sort of, it's weird because this is 1998 and they'd only been together for like 16 years. And Lars is talking about wanting to stick around another 10 to 20 years and that he hopes they keep challenging themselves. And it's nice to see that, you know, all
that
these years
20 years later,
that has been the case, even through the kind of ups and downs of Saint Anger. And
I mean, man, we are, you know, if this came out in 98-ish, I mean, we are 20 years later. And guess what? They're still challenging themselves and they're still making kick-ass
music. It is as if we have one of Dr. Emmett Brown's luxurious DeLorean time machines.
And we just made it to 2018.
And we're here?
Oh my gosh. Metallica, okay, there's one record that's a little weird, but they released two other kick-ass records.
Yeah. Well, all right.
There you go. There's Behind the Music.
It was fun to go back down and check that out.
Of course,
I had a good time.
Yeah. Oh yeah,
I'm sorry to be kind of rushed, man. But it's been a long day of travel.
Oh, you're good, man. I know you're working. You know, I know we didn't specify this at the top of the episode, but you know, as you guys have probably learned as you listen to it, Clint is in Las Vegas doing some stuff with Rodney Atkins, who he plays with. They're going to be on some award. What's the award show? The ACMA.
Countries. I really don't know. Hey, Blake, are you still in here? Blake left. God
man,
damn it!
I'm in here taking a shower, waiting for you, Clint.
I think he felt weirded out about being on the show.
I'm ready to wash you down in here, Clint.
Not now, Blake. Shh.
Shh, Blake, come on.
Anyway, yeah, I'm out here working. But anyway, we burned it down. We did a good job. We got a really good response to our Cover Hour Black and Bonus episode. If you haven't checked that out, go check it out. You can hear the whole EP. You get sort of this running commentary of Ethan and I talking about how he made the record and why the songs are meaningful to us. And people have really been seeming to dig that.
Yeah, I agree. People seem to have a good positive reaction to it. And for those of you that turned this episode on and were confused why we weren't talking about the Mexico City show Binge and Purge, we'll get to it. We decided kind of last minute to do this to kind of take a break because just to give us a little space from that project, because San Diego and Mexico City are so similar, so we want to take a little breath and then come back to it and do a proper, you know, good episode on it.
Hey, we appreciate all of you out there who listen first and foremost, everyone who tunes in, and all the people who engage with us on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook, people who support us, people who send in encouraging emails, people who make us laugh and teach us new shit about our favorite metal band. We really do love and appreciate you all. If you haven't and you're willing, if you could go to iTunes and leave us a positive review, that'd be really helpful. Just takes a second. Just write, "They're, I like them. They're two human beings that I like." go check out Patreon, patreon.com/metalupyourpodcast to check out that EP. We have a bitchin' website, metalupyourpodcast.com. You can buy merch and shirts and koozies. And what else is there, Ethan? Anything else?
The only thing I was going to say is, well, wouldn't it be great to take that truck and go up to the lake and throw a couple sleeping bags in the back? Sorry, I had to do it one more time.
Well, you did it.
I think that's all we got. Yeah, thank you for listening. And everyone, wish Clint good luck with his whatever he's doing in Las Vegas show.
Oh, thank you.
Good luck, Clint.
Good night, Dark Continent. We are Marcy Playground. All right, peace.
Adios.
If you were our advisor, what would you say? Then I would say, delete that.